Hello and welcome to this week's edition of Footballers Live. Hopefully you're enjoying the series, and this week has a Sydney Derby theme with it taking place on Saturday night. Alex Wilkinson, Mr. Dependable, played for the Socceroos at a World Cup, won some trophies with the Mariners, won some trophies with Sydney FC, and won some trophies in Korea as well with Jongbuk Motors. He's a lovely guy, so down to earth. Hope you enjoy his story. Alex Wilkinson.
Hutchinson's free kick, flicked on by Bowich. Good save from Vilafi. It's gone in the end. The rebound tucked home by Alex Wilkinson. His first goal in the Hyundai A-League. That has taken an eternity.
I've seen it, but I don't believe it.
Alex, thanks for your time.
Pleasure, mate.
So, has it turned out the way you wanted to in your career? I know that's a big question first up, but you're pretty happy with the way it's all turned out?
Yeah, definitely. I think, I guess I played football all my life. Started when I was five, and just did it for the love of the game, I suppose. And did that up until I was probably 15 or 16, and wasn't until then that I realised that maybe I had a chance to do it full time and become professional. So, and now in terms of professional career, I'm extremely happy with everything that's happened. I've been lucky enough to play for a few clubs, played overseas, played for your country, and as a professional, I don't think you can ask for too much more.
How'd you get into it in the leafy suburbs of northwestern Sydney?
Just basically, my parents took me down to get me out of the house, and I was bouncing off the walls, lots of energy, always was kicking balls in the house and throwing balls in the house. So the parents said, let's get down and get into some sort of sport. And I had a couple of mates who played for North Ryde RSL, and we knew a few people down there, so they just took me down there when I was, I think, five, and sort of went from there. But I stayed with that North Ryde RSL club for up until about under 12, so I was there for a while.
Where'd you go after that?
Back then it was sort of, they didn't have all this SAP sort of program, and it was you'd play your sort of club games on the Saturday, and then you'd play your representative games on the Sunday. So you sort of play two games weekend, which would have been fun for the parents, driving all over Sydney. But I played for Glazeville Hornsby then. So that started in under 11s, which was just the local sort of rep team down here at Christie Park. And so I got into that team in under 11s and stayed with them until under 15s or 16s, I think. So I was with them for a while.
That is, we're sitting at the Sydney training ground.
Yeah.
That is
literally over the hill, yeah.
A three wood away.
It's funny, I grew up, we're in North Ryde now. I grew up in East Ryde and spent a lot of, spent my whole childhood in this area. As you said, spent 4 or 5 days a week down at Christie Park training. And now, 34 years old, I'm just literally a stone's throw away. It's pretty strange.
How did it accelerate for you? Football, how did it get going in a serious manner?
Yeah, I think, as I said, up until sort of 14s, 15s, I was still just playing for the fun of the game because I liked it. My mates were there. Yeah, it was a little bit more competitive because it was in the representative environment, but for me it was still just sort of fun. And then once it was around the sort of time that Northern Spirit got up and running, and then they sort of established their sort of youth system where they had the youth team and the Colts team. The Colts team was a little bit younger. And I think I was in the 15s or 16s at Glazeville Hornsby when I got offered a full-time apprenticeship in Northern Spirit. So I was in year 11 at school at the time. And that was obviously to quit school and to turn into a full-time professional. So that was the first sort of time that we had to make the big decision, I guess, myself and my family. My parents were really good about it. They sort of were of the opinion that you've got to take the opportunity while you can, and who knows, it will come around again. So I ended up leaving school in year 11 and joining Northern Spirit, which then it sort of started to get, a little bit more serious.
I heard a whisper just a few years beforehand that you're actually a striker, but you got put back because you were very good at seeing things, even as a young kid, and organising people. Even as a young kid, was that happy as a kid? Or
I don't know why. I don't know whether I wasn't scoring enough or what. I don't know what happened. But, yeah, I was a striker up until I was pretty much under 14s, I think, under 13s. So I was a striker for most of my junior career. And then all of a sudden, I think it was in the 14s, I got put at the back one time. And I never got to go back up again, unfortunately. But Yeah, that was the same team. Me and Brett Holman used to play up front for Glasgow Hornsby. So, you know, it's a small world that we're back sort of playing in the A-League together.
Exactly. Yeah, that's the worst thing for every kid, isn't it?
I know, as a young kid, all you want to do is attack and score goals, and all of a sudden you're shafted right at the back, not even into midfield, but you've skipped the whole line and gone straight into the back lines. It's nearly as bad as goalkeeper, but... yeah, look, obviously the coach saw something in me as a defender, and back then I used to play sweeper. You don't really see sweepers, you know, in the formations that teams play nowadays, but, you know, it used to be a bit more of a sort of free roll and roaming around the back line. It was good fun, but, I definitely missed playing up front, that's for sure, for the first sort of year.
How'd you convince your parents that it was a good thing for your life to leave school at year 11?
Yeah, it was a tough decision. It was because I wasn't bad at school. I was doing all right, and I only had a year left. Obviously, I left towards the end of year 11, so I only sort of had year 12 left to finish off my studies. But look, they were really supportive, to be fair to them. We sat down and had a good chat about it, and as I said before, it was sort of, you know, you've got to take these opportunities when they come. And if worst comes to worst, it doesn't work out, you can always go back, and, you know, there's so many options to get your HSC when you're older and whatnot. So they were sort of that opinion, which was great, because, you know, a lot of parents probably would have said the opposite, that you've got to finish your studies and we'll worry about football later. So, you know, very grateful for them to being so open-minded about it. And I guess it's sort of great that, you know, I've been able to sort of continue on since that early stage. Justify the decision, I suppose.
Yeah, it did. Despite the fact that when you were starting to come through, when you were a younger player, that all that was a total shit fight with the NSL closing and where do you play. It turned it on its head in some respects for
especially
you.
Especially at Northern Spirit, yeah. It was a bit of a dark time at the club, yeah.
Slater and Arnold there?
Yeah, no, they'd sort of moved on before all that started to happen, before the darker days came in. And I think we went, you know, 6 months, 7 months without pay for a while there. But for me, being only 17, 18, it wasn't, you know, as bad. It wasn't great, but because I was living at home, I didn't have a family. It didn't impact me the way that it did the older boys and the senior boys who had mortgages, who had families.
6-7 months.
Yeah, it was a long time, and obviously the superannuation, all the other sorts of things weren't paid, and it was a dark time, and interesting for me because, you know, I'd just sort of come onto the scene and was just starting to play, you know, living the dream, I suppose you could say, of being a professional footballer. But on the flip side, you've got a league and especially a club where things were sort of falling apart. So it was a difficult time, and then I'd sort of only been playing in the league a year or two, and then all of a sudden the league shuts down and it's gone for a year and a half, and then, you know, it was sort of, you're thinking, did I make the right decision to leave school? It was only a year ago and all of a sudden I got no job. So I sort of had to bide time for a year and a half, I guess. I worked a bit in retail and played for Manly, played for Ryde City, just to sort of keep fit. And then once the A-League sort of got the go-ahead and the Mariners got the licence and the tick of approval, and Laurie was the coach, I had him at Northern Spirit and he got in contact with me, and that's how I started up there.
There's that famous story of when Northern Spirit ended up playing at Warringah Rugby Park, Pitwater there, that... someone rocked up looking for Laurie McKenna, and they yelled out to the guy who was washing the seats, "Anyone seen Laurie McKenna?" And apparently Laurie goes, "Yeah, you're looking at him."
That doesn't surprise me. Laurie used to, you know, he used to... To be fair, he held that team together for the last sort of year at Northern Spirit. You know, there was a lot of unhappy players. You know, there were times we'd come into training and he could just tell the boys' heads weren't there, you know, and he'd just say, "All right, no training today, boys. We'll go do bowling, or we'll go, you know, have lunch together as a team," or something like that. And just to sort of mentally refresh everyone, and, you know, that togetherness that he sort of brought to the group probably made us and that club last as long as it did, because if he wasn't there, you know, it probably could have ended a bit more prematurely.
I don't have much against the NSL, given the players it produced and given it was so good for football for a very long time in this country, but I do have this concern that people look back with a revisionist look and say that it was better than what we've got now. So seeing you lived through what you did, what would you say to that argument?
I don't think we, you know, it's difficult to say, but I think there's a lot of credit still got to be given to the NSL for the players we did produce. You know, I don't think it can be forgotten at all. You know, we, as you said, we had some fantastic players playing that competition. You know, and it was great to have sort of so many teams in Sydney, I think, and so many sort of derbies going on. But there needed to be change, there's no doubt. The way that competition was going along, it just wasn't working. And for it to sort of stop, and that was the only way that we could sort of refresh things and start again. And look, the level of professionalism, the medical standards, the, you know, infrastructure of the clubs, everything is, you know, 10, 20 times better now. Mm. And that's what needed to happen. And so in that regard, you can't compare. But I think on a playing level and individual talents, I think we definitely had a lot in the old NSL, and that gets forgotten about a little bit, which isn't right. But you know, I think off the pitch, and as I mentioned before, all the other things that come with a club, we're miles ahead at the moment here in the A-League.
Just with your gap year, if you like. So you played at wonderful club, Manly, down there at Cromer.
Yeah, that's it.
Cromer Park, and also at Ryde, you said you played. But you said you worked in retail.
Yeah.
So tell us what Alex Wilkinson, the retail salesman at the Good Guys, was like.
Actually, I did work at Good Guys for a little bit with Laurie, because Laurie actually owned a truck and his son worked for the Good Guys. And so every now and then I used to head up to Castle Hill, where the shop was based, jump on the truck with his son, Scott, and we'd go do the deliveries for the day.
Oh, so you weren't front of house, you weren't sitting
but I'll get to that. I did do that as well.
Okay.
But not with the Good Guys. But yeah, we used to do deliveries for the day, so we'd do the washing machines and fridges and whatnot. And yeah, so I used to do that for a little while. But then I also worked over here at Macquarie Centre for a surf shop. One of my best mates had worked for a surf shop down there for a long, long time, and I asked him if he could get me a gig, and he did. So a lot of the time I was out the back sort of packing and just doing the odd jobs out the back, sorting things, but also was on the floor a little bit doing the retail side of things. But it was nothing I was very... I didn't enjoy it too much. It was something that I wasn't very much used to, but it just had to be done, you know. I needed... you know, obviously to support myself and earn some money. And after leaving school, I guess, you know, it was the only sort of option I had. So, and also knowing that the A-League was sort of starting up in a year's time, you know, it was just sort of those odd jobs and part-time jobs that sort of kept me ticking over.
So how many TVs did you end up selling?
Not too many TVs. I sold a lot of surf gear, but I delivered a lot of TVs.
Delivered a lot
and,
of TVs.
And connected a lot of washing machines, so hopefully I did it right.
Fair enough. But football was your thing, so yeah. How exciting was it when this opportunity came up, and how hard was it to get a... How did it all work in those days when everyone was running around trying to get a gig?
Yeah.
A new unknown.
Well, that's what it was. It was completely sort of unknown, and... you know, as the sort of year developed, you'd sort of hear which sort of teams and what sort of areas are going to look to get a license. And I'd heard pretty early on that the Mariners were looking like an option, and obviously that Laurie was a front runner to be coach. And so once that sort of got the tick of approval, Laurie contacted me and asked if I'd be keen to go up. And obviously knowing him and knowing quite a few other players that he was sort of targeting from Northern Spirit or guys that I'd known growing up, I guess, in football, it was a pretty easy decision for me. And, you know, for the first year there, I commuted from Sydney. I went up and down every day, which was difficult at times. But and then after that, I ended up moving up the coast. But, yeah, look, I was extremely grateful to Laurie, obviously, for not only giving me my chance at Northern Spirit, but then for the lifeline at Central Coast as well, because... you know, without that, who knows if I, you know, would have continued on.
What stood out for you in those first, the McKenna days, the first, what was it, five seasons pretty much of Central Coast's existence? What stood out for you?
Yeah, look, I think just the way that, I guess starting from scratch at a club and the way Laurie embraced that, you know, without someone like him in that area, I don't know if it would have, I guess, established as well as it did. Mm. You know, he's the type of guy who's just, as you said before, he'll do any sort of job and is more than happy to accommodate the fans, the community, and the way we grew that club, the amount of promotional work we used to do was scary. And but it had to be done, yeah, because, you know, it was by far the smallest region in the A-League, and you really needed to get those initial, I guess, the initial ball rolling and the memberships in and the fans to the games and make it a success. And it also helped that the first year we did well on the pitch as well. You know, we made the final of that pre-season. I think we won the pre-season cup or made the... And then there was the Oceania thing that we lost to Sydney in the final, I think it was, and then ended up making the grand final as well. And obviously, unfortunately, losing that. But I think that perfect combination of being willing to do a lot off the pitch but also doing well on the pitch really... I guess started us off and started the Mariners off on the perfect sort of perfect footing.
Were you always the underdog? I mean, you had that year where you had Tony Vidmar come to the club, John Aloisi, yeah. So it wasn't exactly like you were the paupers, but
no.
For the majority of the time there in those first few years, did you feel like you were out of the competition, or did...
I think
it was different behind closed doors.
Yeah, I think it was a little bit different behind closed doors. I mean, we as players sort of never felt that way, but... Then again, as a young player, I wasn't privy to if, say, Sydney or Melbourne were spending a lot more than us. I was just happy to sort of be there and playing. It didn't bother me that, you know, we were underdogs or not. But I think it was, you know, it was used a little bit. And I think that tag came from us being the small community that we were. And you know, that's just facts. It was by far the smallest region that was in the A-League. But... as you said, in year two and three there, we had, you know, a really, really good squad with Johnny, Vidi. You know, end up having Mille in there as well, who's obviously gone on to great things. And
what do you remember of Mille when you rocked up?
I actually knew Mille before he came to the club because we played together in the 20s. And so I sort of I knew him and had played with him a fair bit. And then obviously he was overseas in Croatia, I think at Vartex, and he'd come back and just was looking for a gig. So he was travelling up every day from Sydney. I think he was working in the bank as well, part-time or something like that with his old man or something like that. And it took him a while there to get a contract. I think it ended up being an injury replacement. So he was doing the hard yards for a while there without getting paid, and then obviously got his chance as an injury replacement. I remember we took him up. I think it was to Townsville or something for a pre-season match, and he was all set to play, and then ended up getting gastro the night before and was sick. And you know, the poor bloke had waited that long to sort of get a go, and then obviously couldn't play the game that he was meant to. But you know, credit to him, he kept on going and ended up getting his chance. And when he did, he took it.
So Graham Arnold rocks up, and what happens to the football club, and what happens to your football club when he walks through the door at the Mariners?
I'd worked with Arnie before in the under 20s or the young Socceroos team. He sort of was with Ange when we went to a couple of tournaments. So I knew of him and had sort of worked under him before, which was good. Being a player, obviously knowing a coach coming in sort of helps a little bit. You're a little bit familiar with how he wants to work. But look. I think he straight away brought expectations, belief, you know, and he changed, I think, the way that we went about things a little bit up the coast, and brought in a lot of young players, refreshed the squad a little bit, and brought a lot of success to the region. He's, you know, what he did up there on as we said, a smallish budget compared to a lot of the other teams was very, very good. And, you know, I think...
Siege mentality. That's
one of his favourites. One of his favourites, yeah. And, you know, us against the world and underdogs, you know, he played on that underdog tag a lot, I think. And it really brought the best out of the squad. He's a guy that's very, very good tactically. but he's also a guy that can manage play as well. And he did that really well up the coast. And as I said, brought through some young players who back then no one had heard of, but now are, you know, regulars in the Socceroos squad. So, you know, he really transformed that club for a few years there, and we you know, had some great success.
Did you feel that before then you needed someone like that, because you were, not say coasting along, but you were going along in the A-League and doing your thing?
Yeah, I think we'd you know, we'd had some success, some
you
significant.
Personally, I'm talking about.
Oh yeah, yeah. Look, it was a different challenge, I suppose, for me. You know, I'd been under Laurie a long time. As I mentioned before, I was with him in Northern Spirit, and then for the first, five or six seasons, however long it was, in the A-League. So for me, it was something different, a new challenge, a fresh face, and it was, for me, it was great having him. He's demanding. He's a guy that, as I mentioned before, tactically takes you to another level in terms of your game, and gives you, you know, a lot of, not only individual work, but video work to sort of look at things you're doing right, things you're doing wrong, and those sort of things help your game. And he sort of brought that level of professionalism and accountability at training. And when you've got that in a training environment, it obviously transcends onto the pitch and makes, you know, the game day on the weekend a lot more successful as well.
Did you get best out of yourself at the Mariners on that occasion, or was that to come a bit later on, in the sense that you did leave before the Mariners had their greatest moment?
Yeah, I know.
It's all about timing, but...
No, I think personally for me, I was at the Mariners for 8 years, and I'd, you know, achieved pretty much everything I could up there in terms of, you know, personally and as a team, apart from a grand final. You know, we'd won a couple of premierships, I think played in three grand finals that I ended up losing, unfortunately. Especially a few tough ones to take, but...
do you want to go into that third one?
Yeah, that one was... Yeah, that was...
Have you watched
it? I still don't... Yeah, I've watched the last... I haven't watched the whole game. I watched the last sort of few minutes. I don't understand. I really don't know how it happened, to be honest. It's just... How do you concede two goals in 3 minutes? It's
How long were you numb for?
Yeah, well, I don't know. I mean, I think the whole penalty shootout was a blur, because we just couldn't believe it. We were there, you know. Yeah. Enrique scores that goal with 3 minutes to go, and then obviously that corner. You know, I still think there was a foul in the lead up to that corner. I was still. But I mean, look, and then obviously the corner, the marking was all over the shop, and you know, they score a goal, and you just sort of in the whole lead up to the Pens, and the Pens was just a complete blur for me, because, as I said, I just couldn't believe it we were even there. You know, I thought we were home and hosed, and it was a tough one to take. That was by far the hardest out of the others. Yeah. You know, much more than the others, but is what it is. That's football. That's why everyone loves the game, and I'm lucky now that I ended up, you know, I've got one, and can sort of exercise those demons a little bit.
A little bit, yeah, exactly. How did it come about that you ended up in Korea? At the best club in Korea?
Yeah, I'd sort of, for the last couple of years before I left the Mariners, I'd sort of been looking for a new challenge and been possibly looking to head overseas. And the year before, I'd gone over to China in the off-season, so just after that, grand final loss, I got a call from a team in China, Jiangsu, to go over there for pretty much the A-League off-season on loan. And so the Mariners okayed that, so I went over there.
Mariners are okay because they didn't have to pay you.
Took a bit of pressure off the wage bill.
Because that's when the club was really struggling. Like Arnie was chipping in for
a little bit, yeah.
Buses to get the pre-season games.
We had 1,000 training grounds. We had, you know, boys were driving buses down to Sydney to get a training ground at Knox High School. We used to have two mini buses, and Chris Doig used to always drive the car, so his nickname was Drive. And, you know, all sorts of these stories where it's just, they were struggling a little bit. But, so I'd sort of got that loan deal over to China and spent 4 months there, and then came back for the start of the A-League for the next season. And then fast forward another season on, There was a bit of interest from another club in China that didn't work out, and then all of a sudden I got a call from Korea. I wasn't even aware that, you know, I didn't know the K-League at all. I didn't know too much about Asian football. I knew a little bit about China, obviously, from being there. But it was sort of at the infancy stages, I suppose, of the Asian rule coming in, where, you know, the Asian clubs are making the most of Aussie players. It was sort of just the start of that.
The plus one rule,
yeah. And so it was a tough decision, because off the pitch, I just had my first child. So my wife had just given birth literally 3 weeks before I got the call. And so professionally, I was, you know, ready to go and keen to try something new. But personally, it was a tough decision, just because we were flying or heading over to the complete unknown of Korea and Jeonju, the city of Jeonju, which we just knew nothing about, with a 3-week-old baby. And, you know, we ended up making the decision to go, and the rest is history, I suppose. It was a great time. I really enjoyed my time in Korea, and as you said, they were a huge club, which I didn't know at the time. But they're you know, a huge club in Asia, and a club that really looked after me and made me feel so welcome, and looked after, you know, my family really, really well. And I've only got fantastic things to say about them.
Yeah, I was going to say, because when you go, it's hard enough having a 3-week-old when you've got family everywhere around you and you're in your own environment where you grew up. Like, to go over there with nothing, that's a...
Well, yeah, that's...
Quite a bit cool.
It is, and especially going to a club like that, which are involved in all the competitions. You know, you've got Champions League, the FA Cup, they always make a deep run in. The K-League, which is a lot more games than it does in Australia, you're playing a lot more, and which means that you're spending a lot more time away from the family as well. And so...
They're big on camps, aren't they?
They're big on camps. Yeah,
big
on
pre-season.
Yeah, so if there's a pre-season, we're away for a month. If it's a break in the season for 2 weeks, we'll go away for a week. And it's just sort of, they love a camp style situation where they can sort of control the players and, you know, monitor them, I suppose. And that just I didn't know that at the time going over there, but, you know, I quickly realised that obviously I was going to be away a little bit more than I thought. So it was hard for my wife. And as you said, you know, when you have your first kid, you need that sort of support network around you, whether it's, you know, family or friends, people to bounce things off. And Brooke didn't have that. So, you know, she did really well to be able to cope like she did. And we had regular visitors from Australia come over and visit us. But, the sort of first 6 months was, you know, tough initiation.
What's going to be her payback when you retire?
I'm waiting for it still. She hasn't cashed in yet.
Because there was the World Cup. I'll get to the World Cup story right now then. I remember at the World Cup, we had a little bit to do with the families, and I remember seeing Brooke there. And
yeah.
I said, oh, how is it? It's great. Alex is playing all the games. She says, yeah, it's all right. She looks so tired. I said, what's up? She goes, oh, the Yedinax and the Cahills, they're on my floor. And like, there was 43 Cahills and 74 Yedinax. And I don't think they slept for 3 weeks. Yeah. Somehow, the poor Brooke, she copped it there as well.
And she'd actually left my boy at home, so it was the one time she could actually get some sleep. And she's ended up on the same floor as the Yedinax and the Cahills, who pretty much had their own plane to fly around Brazil. There were so many of them. But
that was funny.
Oh, yeah. Classic.
Not for her, but
for everyone else. It was good value.
How was some of that World Cup experience for you? It was just everything. You happened to be playing the right type of football at the right time.
Yeah.
With the manager that you knew from your under-20s day, viewing that, knowing that he could use you, just all...
Yeah, it was like the perfect storm, really. It sort of just all eventuated really quickly in my national team career. And, you know, I think Ange had been appointed in November the year before the World Cup, and that's when I first got the call up to come into camp. I thought it was a piss take when Joel Freem rang me or messaged me. I thought someone was just taking the piss out of me, and ended up being truth, which is great. Being the truth, which is great. And I went into camp in Sydney, came back from Korea, spent I think 7 or 8 days with the boys in camp. Didn't get to play, but I didn't care. I was just happy to be there and happy to be involved. And then fast forward sort of, you know, 5 or 6 months was the March window. I think we played in England. I think we played Ecuador, was it that day?
Yep, March 2014.
Yeah, March 2014, and made my debut there. Late on in the with about 20 to go, I think we were down to 10 men or 9 men. Someone, I think Mitchie Langrake got sent off. And so went on and were under the pump, and I ended up making a mistake actually. And I think I gave the ball away, and they ended up coming down the right side and crossing in and scoring. And so I'd sort of, it was a mixed night for me because I'd sort of made my debut for Australia, which was, you know, a dream come true and something I'd, you know, waited a long time and worked a lot for. Being, I think, 29, I thought the time for my national team career was gone. So it was a huge night for me and something I was very proud of. But at the same time, I'd sort of made a mistake that had led to a goal, and I'm sort of thinking, will I get another chance? So that was pretty disappointing in that regard. But then the World Cup sort of squad got named. There was 30 men in the squad. Our first camp was up in Terrigal on the Central Coast, which I came back to. We had a warm-up game against South Africa. And then three or four boys got cut from the squad, and we left for Brazil, and I was on the plane to Brazil, which I was still pretty shocked about. Had a warm-up game over there against...
So all this while you're waiting for a tap on the shoulder saying...
Yeah, well, it was just sort of, I just wasn't expecting it, I suppose. And, I ended up playing the game against South Africa in the warm-up game, which was great. I think someone, I'm trying to think who it was, pulled out with a late injury. It might have been... I don't know who it was. It might have been Spira, I think. Had a bit of a niggle or something, and I ended up playing that game, and then getting on the plane to Brazil, and then we had a warm-up game against Croatia over there, and was lucky enough to play that. And then I think three more players got cut, and all of a sudden I was in the final squad, and that was hard to believe, but also a really proud moment.
But then you played all three games.
Yeah, and then it sort of snowballed from there, and then all of a sudden I'm walking out against Chile, hearing the FIFA Fair Play song and the Australian National Anthem. Literally, I think it was my third start for my country, playing in a World Cup, so...
Who was the hardest guy to mark? Van Persie, Robin, Alexis Sanchez, David Villa...
Yeah.
Or Fernando Torres or someone else?
Some initiation, eh? Like, just unbelievable depth of players. And sort of, you're just stepping in these three games in the... they're not friendlies, they're the biggest sort of occasion you can play. And, we had a tough group, but it was, I wouldn't swap it for anything. It was an unbelievable experience. And unfortunately, we didn't quite, get any results. I think that the first half against Chile sort of cost us a slow start, which is, a little bit probably due to the lack of experience in the squad. Yeah. We had a lot of guys who hadn't played
That noise in the first 15 minutes that time in Cuiaba.
Crazy. Goodness. Yeah. The atmosphere at all the games was unbelievable, as you well know. If it wasn't the Aussies supporting us, it seemed like there was just a sea of yellow because they might have been wearing the Brazil jerseys anyway. But
exactly,
it
way.
Sort of just felt like they were cheering for us anyway. And the atmospheres at the game were unbelievable. And that Netherlands game especially was one that, I remember the crowds were phenomenal. And after Timmy scored that goal, the noise that sort of came around that stadium was scary.
Even you got excited then.
I did. Even I managed to get up there and celebrate. Yeah.
Marking those guys, is there any anecdotes, I don't know, if you talk to those guys on the pitch, there's so much happening, or it's just a whir, your head's spinning, trying to contain those guys? Is there
anything It's funny, for me, you spend the whole time leading up to the game looking at the guys you're going to come up against and the team you're coming up against and what they not only do as a team but what they like their individuals are good at. And it's once you cross that line and the game starts, you sort of don't realise. It's just like you're playing any other game. You don't really, for me, realise that you're playing against these guys. And obviously you've got in the back of your mind that what they like to do when they have the ball and whatnot, and the runs they like to make and et cetera. But once you've sort of got that initial touch on the ball and the game's going, it's sort of just like you're out there playing any other game. And, obviously the guys, you talked about, your Van Persie's Robin. Robin was his speed was ridiculous. He was just so quick off the mark and, very difficult to handle. But, for me, Spain were a different class. I don't know whether it was that we were a little bit off the pace that game. where the first two games had taken a little bit out of us, but they were fantastic. Iniesta, you know, Fabregas when he came on, for me, those two just were unbelievable. They were untouchable and we couldn't get near them. But that's part of, I guess, the experience, and as I said, I wouldn't change it for the world.
Is there any disappointment, any sense that you didn't get more from a national team career off the basis of that at the World Cup, or you're happy that you had it and that was that?
No, look, in a way, I thought that, I'd never get the chance to wear the green and gold. I think, you know, I was involved in the 17s, I was involved in the 20s a lot. I played a lot of games for them, but then that next step up to the national team, you know, never really eventuated. And I thought, being 29, that the time had probably passed me by, and you know, I was disappointed, but I was okay with that. And going from that, and then all of a sudden getting to play in a World Cup, you know, play in an Asian Cup, win an Asian Cup, you know, for me, that's more than I can ever ask for. So, you know, I treasured my time with the national team, and you know, loved being in camp with the boys, and you know, especially being in Korea. Where, you know, I'd spend most of the time just talking to my wife on the wall because my boy was too young to talk at that time, so there wasn't too much English spoken. To be able to go back into camp, you know, every few months was fantastic. And, you know, of course I would have loved to play more, but I'm really grateful for the time I had and enjoyed every moment.
How's your career in these days?
Very average. When I was over there, I got enough to sort of get by, if you could say that. The thing is, my original contract was 2 years, and so if I knew I was actually going to be there for 4 years, I probably would have actually tried to learn it a bit better than I actually did. I ended up, you know, staying longer than I thought I would have. And
why'd you stay longer than you thought? Because it was going well.
It was going well, yeah. And I was, you know, originally I signed the 2 year deal, not knowing anything about the club and not knowing anything about the city or the country. And once we got there and settled in, as I mentioned, that first 6 months was a difficult initiation. Just culturally, they're very different people, but they're so welcoming, so friendly. You know, the people at the club would do anything for me and my family. And after that first 6 months, you get to know the city, you get to know the restaurants, you know, what sort of food at the supermarkets is good and all that sort of stuff. And you get to find little bits that, you know, little things that you miss at home, you can find there, and the more you get to know the cities, and we were comfortable there, and we were, you know, life was good. So I had the opportunity to extend my contract, and you know, we sort of took it with both hands.
You've had enough kimchi for a lifetime, though.
Yeah, I'm still not the biggest fan of kimchi. Korean barbecue is good.
Yeah.
Korean barbecue.
As long as you know exactly what meat.
What you're cooking. Yeah.
Do you know?
Yeah, well, we didn't at the start. What I used to do is I used to take a photo of the menu, and then I had a guy who lived up in Seoul who I somehow met. He was a Jeonbuk fan, and he came to one of the games and introduced himself. And so I used to send photos of the menus all through to him, and then he'd write back in English what it was, translations. So once I did that with a few different restaurants, I used to go to them and none others, so I sort of knew what I was ordering and whatnot. But
did some of the things on there, what he wrote back, surprise you somewhat that they'd be on a menu for human consumption?
Yeah, some of the stuff they used, one of the delicacies they loved over there was eel, and just, I could never bring myself to have eel. It was sort of just horrible, to be honest. One of the boys, actually, we had a Belgian guy there who actually loved it. They used to say, everything for the Koreans was good stamina. They used to say, oh, very good stamina. And eel was one of these things, but I just couldn't bring myself to have it.
Because that kind of mentality, aren't they?
Yeah.
In terms of, for an athlete, it's, you have to be
strong.
Like, you look at the Korean national teams and your Korean teams that you play in the Asian Champions League, and they can all run.
Run for fun, and they're strong as well. You know, a lot of people assume that the Asian nations, they got this perception in their head that they're all small and fast and skillful, but the Koreans especially, they're big boys, they're strong, big legs, big calves, and as you said, they can just run for days. I remember Arnie telling us stories of when Goose took over the South Korean team in 2002, and he trained them hard. They had a really big sort of pre-camp before the World Cup, and Goose was doing, you know, double sessions and whatnot every single day. And then after that second double sessions, the Koreans would still be out there practicing, you know, doing extras, and Goose was sort of thinking, what's going on here? What are these, you know, guys made of? But that's just them, like. they just, the trainings are so different to they are here. They're long, they're full of running, like full of long, big pitch games, which are similar to games on the weekend. And the Koreans just, they lap it up. For Westerners, it's so different. But they're really, that's really ingrained in them from a young age. Like, I used to go into, we'd have to, as you said, go into camp a lot. And I'd end up, we'd have training in the afternoon, I'd go home and have dinner with the missus and then come back in at about 9 o'clock at night to the camp. And so I used to come in at 9 o'clock at night and all the young boys, so we're talking 18, 19-year-olds, would be in the gym at 9 p.m. just after not only training with the first team in the Arbor, but having their own session in the morning. They'd be in the gym at 9 o'clock at night doing extras. And that's sort of, in one way you think that's crazy, but it's also a mentality you've got to admire and say, you know, that's why... They've got a great production line of talent.
Time's almost got us, Wilco, which means we've barely got time to talk about Sydney. So for the non-Sydney fans listening to this, you'll be happy about it because you're just going to talk about success. But in one question, and of course the era is not over because you've still got the mainstay of this team that's done wonderful things in the last few years. But you look back at those last 2 years in particular and go, wow.
Yes.
That was even... what we hoped to do, that was beyond what we hoped to do.
I mean, that first year as well, when I'd first come to the club, we, you know, that was an unbelievable year. The records that we broke, the points that we got, only losing one game, just the run that we went on. I think we went 19 games, the first 19 games unbeaten. And then to be so successful and win the double and then to back it up the year after, That was the big challenge going into that second year, was to be able to back it up and do it again. And, you know, we got close. I think we were 3 points off where we were in that first year. Unfortunately, we lost, obviously, in the semi.
Yeah.
But, you know, won the FA Cup. So it's sort of set the standard now going forward, I think, for this club and where we want to be. And, you know, it's a marker in the ground, I suppose. So... you know, that's the and now coming in this year, the challenge is to go 3 in a row Premier's Plate. You know, it had been a long time since anyone had done it, to win 2 Premier's Plates in a row. So to be able to do 3 in a row would be huge. And you know, we were disappointed about the FA Cup. We wanted to be the first team to get back to back in that. It wasn't to be, thanks to Craig Goodwin and his right foot. Looking forward to seeing if he can do that again this year. Saved it for the best occasion, didn't he?
You sound like you have your doubts.
Unbelievable. But you know, that's football sometimes. And hopefully this year we can right the wrongs of last year and go all the way.
When are you done? Not trying to end you.
Yeah, I don't know. I've got another year after this. And the body's still feeling pretty good, which is good. I'm lucky that I'm playing at the back and not in midfield or up front, because I can sort of... I can make other guys run for me if I talk enough and communicate enough. I get the other boys to do a bit of running, but nah, look, it's I'm feeling all right, so we'll sort of see how we go over the next couple of years and we'll go from there.
And then, back to the good guys?
I don't know if I'll be back to the good guys. I'll be coming for your job, mate. I don't know. I don't know what I'll do. I'd love to stay in football.
Yeah.
I don't know whether it's going to be coaching or admin or... media or who knows, but
all of the above.
It'd be maybe a bit of both, but it'd be a shame. I think it'd be nice to stay in the game. It's all I've known ever since I've been a young boy. So to completely exit the game would be disappointing.
Wilco, thanks for the chat, mate. Fascinating story, and best of luck with what's to come.
Pleasure, mate. No worries. Thank you.